Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Keith Wingate, CASA volunteer and board member of Champions for CASA. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate, and Champions for CASA is gearing up for the grand opening of their Champions for CASA Connections Center, Nevada's first dedicated space for foster youth and CASAs. Keith, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what exactly is the CASA program?
The CASA program is a program provided by the 8th Judicial Court here in Southern Nevada. And the CASA program works with the courts to ensure that every child who is in care has someone who can advocate on their behalf. So, if you will, we act as quarterbacks for the court system for each of the cases, where we work with the students, the kids in care, we work with the families, the caregivers, and we are the egg in the batter that secures and makes sure that we are advocating for whatever's in the best interest of the child. That advocacy could look very different depending on the case. Prior cases that I've had where we had to advocate for extra resources for school supplies or school support. Some of the advocacy would be to live with one particular parent or another, or be continued in custody in someone else's care. Some of that advocacy could include just resources and things that that child would need in order to make sure that they are comfortable and that they have a very successful path towards success while they're in care.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, so then what's Champions for CASA?
Champions for CASA is the nonprofit for the CASA program of the 8th Judicial Court. Champions for CASA was created because we wanted to create a space where we could really support the CASA volunteers. As you know, times have changed and advocacy has fluctuated over the years. So we wanted to be able to put an organization surrounding the CASA volunteers to support them with their help of their children or their cases. So what we're hoping to provide for them is recruitment for the program for additional volunteers. We are looking to retain the volunteers that we have, and we also want to recognize the volunteers that we have just to make sure that every child has someone looking out for them while they're in care.
What are some reasons why a child would be assigned a CASA volunteer?
A CASA volunteer is normally assigned by the courts if the judge warrants one needing the, most of these cases are complex. Sometimes the child just needs someone that they can connect with, that they just need that little extra special attention. And those are the cases that I actually have handled currently and in the past. And it's just that extra support for that person to make sure that regardless of all the stakeholders that are in play, we have a neutral person that is there. And they are just looking purely for the best interests of the child.
Okay. And what kind of experience do CASA volunteers need to have?
Volunteer, the experience is that you must be 18 or 21 years, depending on the area of jurisdiction. They go through rigorous training, over 15 hours of training for this. They actually is a background check. But most of all, the overall arching thing that any person who is interested in volunteering, they just need a heart. They need a heart that is willing to be open to care for children who didn't ask to be in the position that they are in. And if they can come with that open heart and that willingness to contribute and to mentor and to advocate for the children, a lot of times that's 3/4 of the way. The other things that we need to do to make sure that the children are safe are just some of the processes and fundamentals that are needed for certification.
Okay. What prompted you to become a CASA volunteer in the first place?
I had a very good friend. His name was Assemblyman Tyrone Thompson. And he was a huge advocate for the program. He would always talk to me about the program. I was already connected in another advocacy group on a board there. And I'd already said that I wanted to reach out and I wanted to help. And then time just not permitted for me because of my schedule. However, something changed in my life and things opened up for me. And so I wanted to go back and revisit that commitment that I had. And I tell you that it's probably one of the best decisions that I've made in my life because I get the reward of seeing children grow and stand into their full potential with the help and guidance and support that I'm able to lend.
That's a good point. What kind of time commitment is involved in being a CASA volunteer?
Oh, well, Heather, the time commitment can vary depending on the case and the severity of the cases. But on average, we're looking for someone for anywhere from 8 to 10 hours on a month. And during that time that you have with that, that is maybe not face-to-face with the child, but you may be researching facts about the case. You may be meeting with teachers, administration, meeting with different peoples of the care team. You're fact-finding and you're researching and you're getting all the inputs that you need in order to be able to form a decision or recommendation on what is best for the child. And so I say on average, 8 to 10 hours. Some cases require more. Some cases require less. It just depends on the case.
Okay. So tell us about your new Champions for CASA Connection Center.
Wow. Well, as I mentioned, part of the role of Champions for CASA is to support the CASA volunteers. And we're excited about this opportunity because we are opening a Champions for CASA Connection Center. And it is a first of its kind space and is designed to serve the CASA volunteers and the foster children that they serve. What happens normally when a CASA volunteer does meet with their child, they end up just meeting in parking lots or fast food restaurants or sometimes in court hallways or just in passing. And we wanted to formalize that connection so that the people, the child and the CASA volunteer can have some meaningful time together. And so we're creating this space that we're opening up on November 19th for CASA volunteers. And it's going to feature different rooms and themes. For example, there's going to be a music studio where the kids can come learn different music skills. There's going to be an offering arts and crafts center. There's a toddler space, a teen room. And we're going to actually even have a fully equipped kitchen so that the CASA volunteers and their kiddos can actually come together and spend some meaningful quality time together. And we're really excited about this venture.
That's amazing. So where is it going to be located?
The CASA Connection Center is located just off Jones and 95. And it is in the central part of town. And it is something that we found a building and we gutted it to its core. And now we're in the process of rebuilding that so that we can make it so special and so memorable for each of the children that we are actually serving.
Yeah, that sounds great. So if someone's listening and this sounds really interesting to them, where could they find more information about the CASA program, the Champions for CASA organization, or even apply to be a CASA volunteer themselves?
Oh, great question. The best place to do any of your research or fact-finding or to follow up from this interview is to visit championsforcasa.org. That is championsforcasa, C-A-S-A.org. And there you'll find information where if you click on the donation tab, or the donate tab, you'll find information about the Connection Center and find ways that you can donate. We are actually building these specialty rooms from the ground up. And so perhaps you want to make a monetary donation, or we have some Amazon lists that we curated. And perhaps you want to go there and just pick that special, unique item that you would like to be used in the home. If you're looking to volunteer, there's a volunteer tab as well where you fill out your information. And then after that, you will be contacted with information about an information session. Once you attend that information session, then you can decide if you would like to advance further to begin your process. And we invite all who can support us in any kind of way. We really look forward to the opportunity to meet and to grow together.
That's fantastic. All right. So once again, the website for Champions for CASA is simply championsforcasa.org. That's championsforcasa.org. You can find out more about the CASA program. You can make a donation. You can see the Amazon wish list or sign up to be a volunteer. And again, CASA stands for Court Appointed Special Advocate. And you can find all that information at championsforcasa.org. And we've been speaking today with Keith Wingate, CASA volunteer and board member of Champions for CASA. Keith, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know more about the CASA program, the difference that you make in these kids' lives, what's involved in being a volunteer, and especially about the new Champions for CASA Connection Center, which is opening up this month. It sounds amazing, and I really appreciate you sharing with us. So thank you so much.
Heather, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to arrange this conversation. The work that you do here with these group of stations and in our community is so valuable and so needed. And we appreciate you, your voice, and your listeners for their support. And we're looking forward to connecting with each of them at some point in our journey together.
I am blessed. After I lost my mom, I was depressed and resentful. I couldn't find my way. But I am not lost.
That's right. I'm Tiffany. I work in behavioral health for youth advocate programs. Yeah, I empower Blessing with tools so she can see her strengths and set positive goals.
As a little kid, I experienced trauma and I acted out. Made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
No, she's a good student and a great kid. As Jalen's YAP advocate, I'm always here for her.
We need YAP. The youth, they need strong support systems. I try to help the youth understand if you have a change of mindset, you can have a change of action.
YAP gives communities alternatives to residential care, youth incarceration, and neighborhood violence. After completing our program, nearly 90% of participants remain in their community. YAP works.
And now I'm finding my way and excited about my future.
Youth Advocate Programs. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn more at yapinc.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Lori Kobo, Executive Director of the UNLV Performing Arts Center. One of their upcoming shows is the world-renowned Vienna Boys Choir with Christmas in Vienna, just in time for Thanksgiving weekend. Lori, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Heather, for inviting us.
So first of all, for those who aren't familiar, what exactly is the UNLV Performing Arts Center?
So the UNLV Performing Arts Center is a part of the College of Fine Arts here on the UNLV campus. We manage the Judy Bailey Theater and the Artemis W. Hamm Concert Hall. Sometimes that's a mouthful. And we've been doing that since the building opened almost 50 years ago now.
But it's not just UNLV Performing Arts students who use the Performing Arts Center.
No, that's correct. The Performing Arts Center also produces its own series of events during the year. And we also do things with community groups like the Las Vegas Men's Chorus, a bunch of dance recitals, Bunker Dance Studio, Arabesque. So it is a rental facility as well. So yeah, we're busy pretty much 365 days out of the year.
Awesome. So speaking of that, tell us about the upcoming Christmas in Vienna show with the Vienna Boys Choir.
Well, we are really excited to have them back. It's been quite some time since they were here. So we're kicking off the festivities of the holiday season. We're doing the Wednesday afternoon before Thanksgiving. So that's November the 26th. And it is a matinee performance on a Wednesday, but all the kids should be out of school on Thanksgiving recess. And it should be just a perfect way to start off the holiday season.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What does it mean to have one of the most famous choirs in the world performing here at UNLV?
Well, it's amazing because the Vienna Boys Choir has always had a following. I mean, their history is really deep. You know, they're 325 years old or something like that now. And it's amazing to be able to put young people on our stage that aren't actually part of our community to show that music is something that encompasses the entire globe, right? So It's neat to see the young people in a different country also participating in a way to share their traditions and their beliefs. So,
yeah, and it's the Vienna Boys Choir, but how old are they exactly?
The boys range from ages 6 to 19, but most of them are going to be primary or grammar school aged, but they do take kids up to the age of 19 because they actually have a high school choir that I was unaware of.
Interesting. Okay. Now, I read that they have 4 different touring choirs. Which one is this that's performing Christmas in Vienna?
I'm not going to be able to pronounce this. Haydnchor.
Haydnchor.
Haydnchor. There you go.
Okay.
Yep, that's the one that's coming to us in November. Yeah.
Okay. So when we talk about boys choir, what type of music is it specifically? I know people have heard them singing, but what are we listening to?
So this particular performance is going to feature music that is folk song, some classic masterpieces, and then some Christmas hymns and holiday carols as well. So it's going to be a pretty diverse program. And, you know, you're asking about the ages, and currently they have 330 boys and girls between the ages of 6 and 19 that attend their school. So it's pretty large, and then they split out into 4 different groups.
And how many boys will be in this particular performance?
I want to say that we're expecting 90 people, 90 choir members, and they will, I guess they're on trimesters, so they do 2 semesters of school in Vienna, and then the other trimester, they're actually out touring the country. So I believe that there's supposed to be about 90 voices on stage.
Wow, that's really interesting. And how long does the performance run?
We actually haven't gotten a total count yet, but it should be somewhere between an hour and 30 to an hour and 45 minutes.
Nice. Okay. And obviously, this is a great introduction to the holiday season. But generally speaking, how does this type of art fit into the Las Vegas entertainment scene that we all know and love?
Well, choir has always been a big component, even when we just actually did the CCSD honor choir, both middle school and high school, in the concert hall last week. And it is one of the largest attended events for the school district. The choir program is so immense, and I know that a bunch of the choir teachers are really excited about Vienna coming back. So I anticipate that we'll have a really solid crowd for that Wednesday performance. Choir is just, it's one of those things that's really easily attainable to most people. You know, there's a difference between going to like an orchestra or band concert where you actually have an instrument you have to play, because all of us have voices. Whether you believe that you're a great singer or not, we all have voices and have the ability to enjoy the music and participate. So,
yeah. Absolutely. All right. You mentioned it's a matinee. What time is the show on Wednesday, the 26th?
It's 3:00 in the afternoon, and we're looking at doing some special holiday type themed drinks and maybe some specialty items at the bar. So don't be surprised if we have like apple cider and hot cocoa and stuff like that.
That sounds great. So where can people go if they want to find out more or get tickets to the Vienna Boys Choir Christmas in Vienna show?
Please visit our website. It's PAC, which stands for Performing Arts Center, pac.unlv.edu.
Perfect. All right. So once again, the website for the Performing Arts Center at UNLV is pac.unlv.edu. vienna.edu, and you'll see the Vienna Boys Choir right there on the front page. If you'd like to get tickets to see the show, just follow through the buy tickets links. All of it's right there. And again, the Vienna Boys Choir will be at the UNLV Performing Arts Center on November 26th at 3 p.m. with the world-renowned Christmas in Vienna show, which is a fantastic way to kick off the holiday season. PAC.UNLV.edu is the website. And we've been speaking today with Lori Kobo, Executive Director of the UNLV Performing Arts Center. And Lori, it's always so interesting talking to you and finding out the amazing performances that are going on right here in the community at the university, where not everyone expects these world-renowned shows to be taking place, but there they are happening.
Yes, all they year are. Round.
It's fantastic. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thanks, Heather. I really appreciate it.
What's the biggest myth about interscholastic performing arts? That you have to be the most talented or experienced to participate. The truth is, anyone can be a part of their school's performing arts. There are countless opportunities for students to participate, from theater, choir, and band to speech and debate. The bottom line, if you want to perform, there's a place for you.
This message presented by the NFHS and the NIAA.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Joanne S. Bass, retired 19th Chief Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force and the first woman to become the highest senior enlisted leader in any military service. November is Military Family Month, and some new programs are helping veterans access support, from legal aid and mental health services to housing and caregiver resources. Chief Bass, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
So first of all, how has your military background impacted your life as a whole?
Absolutely. You know, I tell people all the time that my dad used to always tell me that 4 years in the military never hurt anybody. And he was right. You know, I had the honor and the privilege to serve in the United States Air Force for over three decades. And that time in the Air Force, every year, every assignment that I had really shaped the person that I am and has given me so much more that I can continue to give back. And so that is really what I'm doing is, you know, while I'm not wearing the uniform any longer, I'm still serving our veteran community just in different ways.
Yeah. What inspired you to become an advocate for military veterans?
You know, as I mentioned, you never quite take the uniform off. And while I was serving as the Chief Master in the Air Force, while I was primarily focused on the military mission, I was also focused on the people behind the mission, as well as their family members, and really making sure that we set the conditions to which all of our service members can thrive and be their very best for our nation. Shortly after I retired, I'll tell you, I had an opportunity to read a white paper that kind of came across my desk, and it was called Serving Those Who Served, and it was written out by PMI US, and I was so just appreciative of the listening that this company did. In fact, they're here with me today, but I'm so appreciative of the listening that they did to our veteran community in ways that they can put their money where their mouth is and really have some meaningful actions to be able to support our military members and their families as they transition from military service. And they're not just the only ones. I also do work with Hiring Our Heroes, Columbia Southern University, the Bob Woodruff Foundation, the Robert Irvine Foundation. There's so many organizations that are really trying to get after taking care of our veteran community.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, of course, PMI we know as a tobacco company, but now they're putting their money behind this new mission. What are some of the top priorities?
Well, I will tell you, you know, as I think about our veteran community, what I will share is that they have really done a good job of listening to what are some of the challenges that our veterans have and how can they be helpful and understanding what they are and modeling to other companies as well what right is and how do we look at ways to which we can bring them into our workforce, but also how can we take care of them from different things such as, you know, mental health, legal aid, and all the other things to which our veterans are in need of when they enter into the communities.
And how do veterans get access to some of these services and resources?
Well, we are not, as veterans, short of any resources. There's over 40,000 veteran service organizations out there. And so our veterans really do know where to get some of the resources that they have. But one of them, they can start by finding that white paper that I read off, which is Serving Those Who Served, and they can find that at uspmi.com. And it'll have some of the resources, but more specifically, resources for companies and communities to figure out ways in which they can help support the veteran community.
Okay. Now, when you speak about the people behind the uniform, what are some of the key strengths and talents that veterans and those serving in the military have that others might not be aware of?
Heather, there are so many, but if I can highlight just a few, I will tell you, when you spend time with a military veteran and their family member, you're going to see strong work ethic, you're going to see adaptability, you're going to see problem solvers, and also they're some of the most resourceful and resilient people ever. And again, I have to foot stomp, it's not just a veteran, but it's also their family member who really does have those key strengths.
Yeah, that's interesting. So why is it important that the whole society comes together to support veterans?
Yeah, I talk about a whole of society effort because not one single organization can ever do it alone. It will take all of us. It'll take government, it'll take businesses, it'll take academia, nonprofits, and the community to really think about ways to which we can care for our veteran community. Every single one of us has a role. And that's because when we take care of our veterans and their families, and when we include them in the workforce, as well as in our communities, it is a win to all of us.
Yeah, for sure. You did mention the website, but one more time, where can people go to learn more, whether they're a veteran or a loved one, a family member, or even just a community member looking to support veterans?
Absolutely. I would say start where I did and go check out that white paper, Serving Those Who Served. You know, that is just one resource that will highlight all the different ways that you can, you know, understand the veteran community. But 3 points, if I can share, you know, I always think about connect, opportunities, and care. If you connect with somebody who is a veteran or a family member, you will learn so very much, and that'll help you understand how all of us can play a role in being able to care for our folks and looking for those opportunities to bring them in. Again, not because of a handout. A veteran never wants a handout. They simply want a hand up because of the talents and the leadership that they bring to your organization and the leadership that they're going to bring into your communities.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so once again, the website is uspmi.com. You can download that white paper, Serving Those Who Served. You can find out more information. It's Military Family Month, so it's a great time to look at supporting military members, but of course, all year round, that's important as well. We've been speaking today with Joanne S. Bass, retired 19th Chief Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force. Chief Bass, I really appreciate you being here, sharing your perspective, your amazing career in the military, what you've been able to achieve, and what you're doing now to help veterans and communities as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
Heather, thank you so much.
Many of our U.S. veterans and service members face challenges: mental health struggles, housing obstacles, employment, food insecurity, and social isolation, to name just a few. I'm Bob Woodruff. My family and I started the Bob Woodruff Foundation in 2006 after I sustained a life-threatening injury while reporting from Iraq. Our service members had my back that day, and we need to have theirs now more than ever. At the Bob Woodruff Foundation, we raise awareness about the tough challenges veterans and military families face and invest in solutions to help support them in the next chapter of their lives. And with one solution comes the next. We solve a housing situation, we increase employment opportunities. We solve employment problems, we address food insecurity. We solve food insecurity, we impact physical and mental health issues. Learn more about our work at bobwoodrufffoundation.org/success.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Ed, a U.S. Army veteran living with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. November is Military Family Month and National Family Caregivers Month. Someone in the U.S. is diagnosed with ALS every 90 minutes, and veterans are twice as likely to develop it as those who haven't served. Ed, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So what is your experience as a veteran now living with ALS?
Well, my experience is most of my journey has been through the VA trying to discover what I had. And so it took a long time because ALS is one of those diseases that mirrors a lot of other things. And so with doctors and the VA involved, my wife and I were able to discover what was going on for me. And as a veteran, I tried to tell vets that they should go to the VA. Our VA is very strong here, and they have excellent doctors and nurses. And so I've had a good experience, even though I have a disease. They've been great for me.
Yeah, that's great. Now, since it took so long to diagnose, what are some of the symptoms that you've experienced as part of ALS?
Well, I don't think anybody really knows what ALS is. And so for me, when we got diagnosed, you know, doctor says you have ALS, we didn't know what to think. And so is it one of those things where you die right away or you get sick? And it's a very progressive disease. Like for me, it's been 3 or 4 years. For other people, it's just a short term. And so it's just mind boggling. And then you have to have caregivers and you have to have medication and you got to be aware. You got to have a strong support group. And I have friends at coffee that get my coffee for me. If I get food, they cut it up. And so as you progress, all of a sudden things quit working. And that's when you got to have people help you do stuff because the symptoms can be your hands don't work like for me or your arms, you can't lift them. And everybody's different. I have friends in our ALS group that are completely different from me. One guy's in a wheelchair completely. Another guy's at the same point I am. And one person has lost his voice. So he uses a system with a computer to type. And so there's all kinds of apparatus out there to help you do the things. And so we're glad about AI. So I don't know if that's something, but.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, those symptoms, as you mentioned, they're all over the place. It could be any number of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, that's an interesting point about veterans being twice as likely to develop ALS as those who haven't served in the military. Why do you think that is?
Well, for my age group, I'm 77. You know, we were all in Vietnam and I was in combat. So there was always the Agent Orange thing being sprayed. There was the stuff in the jungle and diesel fuel. And so I think that's why veterans, I think about that a lot. You know, why do I have this? But my wife's friend is a teacher and nobody knows why she got it or where she got it, you know? And so it's just a weird, a lot more people have it than I thought, especially veterans.
Yeah. What would you like your fellow veterans to know about living with ALS?
Well, today I'm partnering with MTPA to help raise awareness about the disease and the places you can go. And there's a site called RadicavaORS.com that they can find information. And then everybody has a different experience with ALS. So they should talk to their doctor because there's all kinds of different serious things that happen with different drugs, like hypertensive reaction or sulfate allergic reactions can occur. But the most common, like for me, is bruising, and I have to use a walker. I use a wheelchair part-time, and I get real fatigued. And it doesn't take long. I get tired eating, and that's not good. It's important to work with your doctor to know if your treatment is right for you.
How do you maintain a positive mindset throughout all these challenges?
Well, the drugs definitely help. So I try to stay involved in the community. I have a coffee group that I go to almost every day. And then my wife and I volunteer at different organizations because even though you have a disease, there are some great people out there that are more than willing to help you in and out of the car or do whatever. And so sharing your story with all of your friends and family is probably the first thing you got to do. I started telling everybody right away that I had ALS, you know, and then most people my age know who Lou Gehrig is, and they know the story, you know. And Lou Gehrig's quote from the video was, although I have been dealt a bad defeat, but I am still the strongest man in the luckiest man in the world. And so I think that's really true. And he told 50,000 people at one time he had ALS.
Yeah, wow. And then speaking of sharing your story, the other website is shareyouralsstory.com/ed, and it's put out by Radicava. What can people learn if they go to share your ALS story?
Well, they'll find that there's people just like them that have the same problem. You know, it just doesn't pick one kind of person or one type of person. I mean, it's something that they need to learn and do as much research as you possibly can to find out what's going to work for you and how do you take care of your, because you got to be aware of one of the things that happens that people don't talk about is as I lose my ability to do things, my caregiver, my wife, has to take on more responsibility. So she's living for two people.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So once again, the website is shareyouralsstory.com/ed. This is a website for both ALS patients and their caregivers, shareyouralsstory.com/ed. And you can find out more about it there. We've been speaking with Ed, U.S. Army veteran living with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And this is Military Family Month. It's National Family Caregivers Month. It's a good time to have this conversation about ALS and the fact that veterans are twice as likely to develop as those who haven't served. But this is a disease that affects sufferers year-round. So, Ed, I really appreciate you being here, sharing your personal journey, your personal story with us, letting us know what it's like living with ALS and what you're doing to keep that positive attitude and help others as well. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure working with you, Heather. You did a nice job.
Do you know a veteran in need? After leaving the military, many veterans struggle to find their way home. Because to a veteran, home isn't just a place. It's an idea, a feeling. Nation's Finest understands the challenges veterans face. Through the VA's Supportive Services for Veteran Families program, we help veterans and their families struggling with rent, employment, and other housing-related costs. Today, Nation's Finest operates more than 30 locations in California, Arizona, and Nevada. For more than 50 years, we've helped thousands of veterans in these communities build happy, healthy, and purposeful lives. And our team is committed to supporting those who've served in their families for another 50. To get help, visit nationsfinest.org or call 1-833-468-9676. That's 1-833-468-9676.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Ashish Panchal, Chair of the American Heart Association Emergency Cardiovascular Care Science Committee. Every second matters in an emergency, and that's why the American Heart Association is releasing its 2025 guidelines for CPR and emergency cardiovascular care. Dr. Panchal, thank you so much for being here today.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So what are the key updates in the American Heart Association's new CPR and emergency cardiovascular care guidelines?
Yeah, the new guidelines are really focused at bringing the newest science to everyone. That's lay rescuers and our healthcare professionals. The 2025 guidelines really update those life-saving recommendations that we use every single day for patients who are undergoing cardiac arrest, or even someone who is choking or experiencing an opioid overdose. The great part of this is we made it easier for everyone, lay rescuers like you and I, to remember this and to use it to save a life.
Okay, what are some ways that it helps us remember and use it?
Yeah, so there's a couple of clear, key, simple steps which were identified in this update. So let's first start with cardiac arrest. When someone suddenly collapses in front of you, perform hands-only CPR. And this is for adults and teens, and this is the basics. Call 911, push hard and fast in the center of the chest. So that's cardiac arrest. Now, what about choking? The choking had a pretty big update. we want to do repeated cycles of 5 back blows followed by 5 abdominal thrusts for adults and children. Now, for infants, this is a little different. This is a caveat. For infants, we want to do 5 back blows and 5 chest thrusts because we want to maintain and protect the bellies of those vulnerable infants. Last but not least, we need to think about, and we definitely need to consider, the opioid epidemic that we're facing. In these guidelines, the use of naloxone for someone experiencing or suspecting overdose is highlighted, and then it's directing people to really focus on guidance from the public to really get that Narcan and have it available so that you can save a life. In the end, recognition of the emergency and being ready to help is what can save so many lives.
Okay. Now, for example, let's take the choking because that seems to be kind of a common scenario. 5 on the back, 5 abdominal thrusts. How does that change from what we used to do? Was it just the Heimlich abdominal thrusts before?
Exactly. That's a great point. So what we used to do was suggest like the Heimlich maneuver, doing abdominal thrusts. The newest data that we've looked at as we did the update for these guidelines really showed that to get that foreign body airway obstruction cleared, the best way is 5 back blows followed by the 5 abdominal thrusts. And that's why it led to that change. Pretty big change though.
Yeah, definitely. So when you talk about hands-only CPR for cardiac arrest, I think a lot of people are concerned about doing it too hard, too soft, not the right speed. What are some quick guidelines to know that we're actually doing that properly?
That's a great question. I think a lot of people have a lot of fear around just stepping in and doing this. The most important thing to consider is when somebody has a cardiac arrest event, nothing you can do is going to hurt them because they may be dying at the moment. And truthfully, when you start your first compression, your hands are literally their heart. Every compression brings this person that much closer to being back to their family neurologically intact. Without you there, they're not going to survive at all. So doing that hands-only CPR, calling 911, getting the people there to help you, and then pushing hard and fast until that help arrives to then take over is exactly what you can do to save that person and bring them back home to their families.
Okay. And you're saying we don't need to worry about the mouth-to-mouth?
Great question. So a lot of our data in the past has really focused on looking at the concept of mouth-to-mouth versus hands-only CPR. And we found that hands-only CPR is really, really good to save lives. Now, if you feel comfortable and you're trained, feel free to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because that oxygen will help in the end. And when those rescuers come in, they're definitely going to be giving ventilations. So if you're able to do it, that's great. But if you're a lay rescuer and you've never done anything like this, hands-only CPR is more than enough to save that life.
Fantastic. Okay, so speaking about lay rescuers and bystanders, what's the new chain of survival all about?
That's a great question. The new chain of survival really puts us all on the same sheet of music. The chain of survival talks about a unified chain where we can do the same steps, may it be out of hospital, in hospital, for pediatrics, adults. It's the same key steps, starting with recognition of the event and starting emergency response, followed by high quality CPR to really help someone. The next being defibrillation. Get that AED there so that if they need a shock, they can get a shock and you can get coaching from that AED. From there, you'll be handing it off to the EMS clinicians who will really take this person and take them to the hospital and get the care that they need. But those steps are consistent and it simplifies it for the lay rescuer so we know exactly what our role is during a cardiac arrest event.
All right, that's awesome. Now, what could parents and caregivers do to help their loved ones be prepared in case of a future emergency?
That's the key. With the holidays coming up, Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever the case may be, when all is said and done, we need to be prepared because so many of these events happen in the home. It's going to be your moms, your dads, your aunts, your uncles. And we know CPR saves lives. We know knowing what to do for choking saves lives. And so with that in mind, we need your support to ensure that everyone learns CPR and everyone who needs it receives it. So it starts with learning it yourself. Take a class, learn what you need to do in an emergency because everyone has a role in the chain of survival and in saving a life.
Awesome. So where can listeners go for more information about the American Heart Association 2025 guidelines for CPR and emergency cardiovascular care?
Yeah, if you want to learn more, go to heart.org/nation. You'll learn a lot about the Nation of Lifesavers and how you can be part of that movement to continue saving lives. Thank you so much.
All right. Awesome. So once again, the website is heart.org/nation. That's the American Heart Association, heart.org/nation. If you want to find out more about the Nation of Lifesavers and how you can be part of that movement to be a lifesaver, you'll find the 2025 guidelines with the updates we've been talking about today for CPR and emergency cardiovascular care as well. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Ashish Panchal, chair of the American Heart Association Emergency Cardiovascular Care Science Committee. And Dr. Panchal, I really appreciate you being here, sharing these updates with us in such a simple and easy to remember way. I'm sure a lot of people, just having heard the interview, are now much more prepared for the next tragedy that may occur, but hopefully they'll take a deeper look at the guidelines as well and be even more prepared. So thank you so much for sharing today.
It is indeed my pleasure. Thank you again.
I'm Emmett Smith. Opioid poisonings cause the most accidental deaths in the U.S., and I've lost loved ones. But now, I'm prepared to save a life. Just remember, lay, spray, stay. Lay the person on their back, use Narcan nasal spray, dial 911, and stay with the person until help arrives. Continue to administer additional doses as needed. An opioid poisoning can happen to anyone, anywhere, anytime. Always be ready to rescue. Learn more at readytorescue.com.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Kai Walker, Managing Director of Workplace Benefits Research and Inclusion Transformation at Bank of America. With higher living costs and persistent inflation, American workers are looking for advice around long-term savings and managing their current personal finances. And according to Bank of America's 2025 Workplace Benefits Report, more than a quarter of the workforce is seeking help from their employers. Kai, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Heather. Thank you.
So what are some of the biggest takeaways from your 2025 Workplace Benefits Report?
Yeah, you know, I'll start with what you've just introduced. That is the fact that more and more people are looking for help with needs around short-term and long-term finances, things like emergency savings, controlling debt, and managing the cost of rising healthcare expenses. And what they're doing is turning to their employers for that help, largely because it's the employer who provides, you know, benefits around healthcare, 401k plans, and things of that nature. And as you've mentioned, we've seen the number of employees looking for help from their employers double just in the last 2 years alone. And so the good news, I guess, with this is the fact that we also spoke to employers, and over 95% of them say they feel some level of responsibility for the financial well-being of their employees.
Interesting. Okay. So then what tips do you have for American workers who are looking to improve their finances?
Yeah, absolutely. So to the extent that, again, the sentiment amongst employers that they feel some level of responsibility, I would say in terms of maybe the first bit of advice I would give is ensure that you're speaking and in contact with your employer around the various tools that they might offer. Many of them offer sort of tools and calculators to help you start saving around a budget, saving towards emergencies, and you can track your progress to goals through some of those same tools. The other thing I would note is many employers are also offering educational resources. So think of seminars and webinars that cover a variety of different financial topics. Ensure that you're taking advantage of those as well. And then the third thing I'll mention is many employers are offering a variety of different benefit programs, some of which you may not be currently tapped into today. So things such as caregiving resources, debt management resources, again, financial tools and calculators and other forms of guidance, some being in person as well. So make sure you're taking advantage of those. And then the last thing I'll mention is around the topic of healthcare. Many employees have access to what's called a health savings account. That allows you to save for healthcare expenses, both in the short term and the long term. And there's tax advantages to saving in a health savings account. To the extent you have access to one, be sure to ask your employer about that and begin contributing to the extent you can.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what advice do you have for people looking to build their retirement savings specifically?
Yeah, you know, when we spoke to employees about this, what many of them said was that they wish they had started saving earlier, they wish they had started saving more, and that they took advantage of any employer contributions that were being contributed on their behalf to their retirement plan. So my advice would be this, given those wishes that we've heard and sentiments expressed by other employees. So I would first say start early if you can, and it's never too late. So if you're mid-career, you know, certainly it's never too late to start saving and contributing, let's say, to your employer's 401k plan. And oftentimes those employers will make matching contributions, which leads to the sort of the second bit of advice that I would give. To the extent possible, make sure you're maximizing those contributions. So for example, if your employer is matching up to 6% and you're only contributing 4%, you're leaving 2% of free money on the table. So make sure that you're not, to the best of your ability, that you're not doing so and that you're maximizing those contributions. And then I would say further, as we're coming into year end, so for many employees, for example, you might be receiving a year end bonus, or perhaps this is the time that merit increases for the following year are being issued. Consider those things in terms of the contribution amounts that you are contributing. Those added dollars can go a long way when you think about compounding interest over the course of your working career. So make sure you're fully utilizing those increases and maximizing those contributions to the best that you can.
Yeah, great advice. Now, what are some hidden costs in retirement that savers don't typically account for?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And this was really surprising to me. So we asked this question. Let's assume that you are a married couple retiring at the age of 65, how much on an annual basis do you anticipate you would spend out of pocket on healthcare? And that's, again, above, beyond, let's say, Medicaid benefits and the like. And the answer that came back most frequently was $5,000 a year. However, the latest research shows that a married couple retiring at the age of 65, just in out-of-pocket expenses alone, could spend upwards of $430,000 in terms of healthcare expenses during the course of retirement. So I think that's a big wake-up call. And again, I mentioned health savings accounts previously. This could be a great vehicle to the extent you have access to one, where you could begin saving not only for your immediate healthcare expenses, but investing those dollars for the long term as you contemplate retirement somewhere down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so where can listeners go for more information about healthy financial habits?
Well, certainly I would go to your employer again. They have resources available to help you. Again, those online tools and calculators, in-person meetings, webinars, seminars, and the like, I would start there. But Bank of America also offers something called Better Money Habits. BetterMoneyHabits.com is a free resource. It will do everything from provide guidance around how to set up a basic budget, how to begin investing, all the way through to estate planning. It's a free resource. It's available to anyone who wants to access this, and it's all education-based. It's not an infomercial about the bank or anything like that.
All right, awesome. So once again, ask your employer about any benefits. It's open enrollment. This is the end of the year. It's the perfect time. Find out what's available to you and maximize that. And if you want more information about healthy financial habits in general, saving, credit, and making a better financial life, go to bettermoneyhabits.com. BetterMoneyHabits.com. And we've been speaking today with Kai Walker, Managing Director of Workplace Benefits Research and Inclusion Transformation at Bank of America. Kai, I really appreciate you being here. This has been some really interesting data that you've shared with us and some great solutions for people who are working towards a better future. So thank you so much for sharing today.
And thank you, Heather, so much. Appreciate it.
Did you know VA home loans are a key to home ownership for those who served?
I would tell anybody who is interested in getting a VA loan to just do it.
For me, the best thing about the VA loan was the simplicity of it. I was expecting, you know, government paperwork, it was going to go on forever, and it just wasn't.
Since the down payment for a VA loan is minimal, we were able to purchase this home and then use the money that we were going to use as a down to actually fix up the home.
And the only way we could do that was because the nest egg that we had saved for the down payment, we didn't have to use because we went the VA route.
This is a wonderful benefit that veterans can take advantage of.
In the military, we make a lot of sacrifices. We're away from our family a lot. And with the VA loan, it's a way that it makes it easier for us to get a home.
To learn more about VA home loans, visit va.gov/homeloans.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Silver State Equality is holding its annual Silver State Equality Awards Ceremony this Wednesday, November 12th at 6 p.m. at Chaos Nightclub inside the Palms Casino Resort. The awards celebrate Nevada's LGBTQ+ achievements and honor inspirational leaders. This year's honorees include TV personality and humanitarian Lisa Vanderpump, and former Las Vegas City Mayor Jan Jones Blackhurst. Get your tickets or find out more at silverstateequality.org. That's silverstateequality.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, November 17th at 8 p.m. benefiting Sing Out for Autism. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada is holding their annual Thanksgiving Turkey Drive to feed local families, and you can help by dropping off frozen turkeys and non-perishable Thanksgiving meal items up until Thanksgiving at their campus, 1501 North Las Vegas Boulevard, south of Owens, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. You can also make an online donation, with every $25 providing a full Thanksgiving meal for a family. Find out more, donate, or sign up to volunteer at CatholicCharities.com. That's CatholicCharities.com.